Hello, I'm Jamila Krempel, and I'm your guest host for this episode of Life in the Balance. This show focuses on the people behind the issues, merging policy concerns with first-person storytelling to get at the root of entrenched problems here in Baltimore. Today, we're discussing making ends meet, how many people are able to do it, and what supports exist when they can't. We're going to be using an acronym a lot on today's show. It's ALICE, A-L-I-C-E. It stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. The acronym was created by the United Way, and their 2018 ALICE in Maryland report reveals that many families across the state are struggling to afford basic necessities. The federal poverty threshold for a household of four is $24,000, but Maryland's ALICE survival budget for a family of four is almost $70,000. Trying to account for inflation and rising cost, the General Assembly approved a bill that would raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2026. For many people living in Baltimore and beyond, they're not making enough to keep up with the 2019 cost of living, and that's creating a mountain of stress. How are organizations and government agencies supporting people with income constraints, and in what ways are they not able to meet the need? In a bit, we'll hear from the head of the United Way of Central Maryland and with GEDCO, the Govens Ecumenical Development Corporation. But joining me right now is Doreen Hicks. When she's not working full-time at her job as a housekeeping supervisor, she's a leader with United Workers, an organization here in Baltimore dedicated to the rights and well-being of workers. Doreen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Doreen, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up?
I grew up all over Baltimore City. My mother was a gypsy. I call her a black gypsy because we never really had a place to stay. After we moved from Flag House Court when I was 5, maybe 6 years old. After Flag House Court, it was people's houses. I was able to actually benefit from being in one house for 4 years only because I cried. I cried like a baby just to stay in one place during high school because I wanted to graduate. Other than that, I don't recall ever being in a house no longer than a month, maybe 2 months, because my mom would move. Couldn't pay the rent. She always had friends that would allow her to stay over with her two kids, me and my brothers 2 years older than me. People were gracious. Churches would help us out. And we had plenty of places to travel to.
Tell us a little bit about your home life today. Where do you live? Who do you live with?
Currently, I reside in a house that we rent with my husband, my daughter, and two homeless guys. Mm. And we strive and survive. We stay together because it's a necessity. Everyone has a roof. Everyone has food. And everyone chips in and makes sure the place is decent and dishes are done, bathroom's clean. I mean, everything is done.
And is did you know, obviously you know your husband and your daughter, but did you know the other two gentlemen that you
no,
live with?
No, not when we moved there.
Wow.
When we moved there, it was just us three. And it was another young guy who was her boyfriend at the time. And we all moved together from a two-bedroom apartment to a three-bedroom house. The substantial increase in rent cost us a lot. The worst part about it is we couldn't afford to get into a regular apartment, even though my husband was making enough money to get into a regular apartment for cheaper. But since we have financial issues, ergo evictions, that we couldn't afford to pay off, they're still hanging over our head. And no regular apartment would allow us to move in. So we rent from a private owner and all the problems that come with it.
And at some point in all of our lives, money becomes a stressor. It could be a car repair bill or, you know, the birth of a child, the loss of a job. There's always something that, you know, a story that that some of us have.
I have many.
Yeah, what has it been for you?
Life is like a train wreck, one after the other. This house has been a big train wreck. We've been there 5 years. In the 5 years we've gone from flooding to electrical to structural.
Have you been responsible for paying for some of the repairs?
We've been repairing a lot of it out of our own pockets. We weren't supposed to. But we were supposed to have been buying the house. We decided not to because of all the issues and how much it was going to cost to do the repairs. And whatever construction work that they did, half-assed as it may have been, are now problems that
have to be
major repairs until we move. And right now, we don't have any place to go. And the landlord knows it.
How many sources of income do you and your husband have to rely on?
We have two at the moment, just him and me. He's now drawing unemployment because he's been laid off from work. And myself, the full-time job. I'm just thinking about 2017 when things were really lucrative and I had four streams of income.
Four.
I had two. And
four jobs.
I saved.
And you saved.
I had to save. And just at the end of 2017, a whole string of unfortunate events happened in my life. Just mine. Everyone else was good. Started in September 2017. Burnt leg due to vein disease and getting treatments. Since I had health insurance, I thought I'd take care of the big elephant in the room. My legs. Got a burn in my leg. Turned out, end up using a cane, which turned around to tennis elbow. Straight from tennis elbow to a car accident December 17th. And I was out of work for 10 months. On leave, which was unpaid leave. So that whole four streams of income left.
You had to draw off on your savings.
Yes.
You had to live off of it, essentially.
Live off of it. And it was gone. Before I was even done with that 10 months, I was trying to get public assistance, unemployment, anything. I thought I was going to lose it. Because there was nothing that could help me through that. And no one gave me anything. Except maybe we got a little bit of food stamps. And $37 does not feed four people.
In the Alice report, which we'll discuss in detail in later on in the show, the largest monthly costs in Maryland come from first housing, then transportation, then health care. How does it look for your household?
The largest bill pretty much we have in our house is the rent. Second comes gas and electric, fuel.
Mm-hmm. So it's fuel, it's oil.
Fuel, then food.
What about healthcare costs?
Healthcare. We're trying to
or
stay away
bills.
From that. We pay them when we can. We got plenty of bills sitting at the house. The car accidents, those have to be covered by something else because the insurance company won't cover. Mm. I don't know. The health insurance, we pay what we can.
Are you covered? Do you have coverage?
As of right now, we're in a gap.
I see.
Our coverage actually ended in February. And they're saying that the income that my husband had before he got laid off and what I'm making now disqualifies us from getting free health insurance because that's what we were getting before. I don't know what happened, but I think they took my daughter off of the Maryland Health Connection plan. And when they did that, that means that the amount of money we had was more than what two people are supposed to get. They don't take into consideration how much you owe out of that money. All they take
expenses.
Into consideration is how much you're getting in. I mean, if you're paying out 90% of that money to food, rent,
fuel,
bills,
everything you
fuel.
Said.
You don't have any money to pay for health insurance. What are they thinking? I mean, you're supposed to take all that into consideration. A phone bill is, I can't say it's a necessity, but if you want to keep a job, it is a necessity because they need to get in contact with you.
How do you handle, you know, these struggles, these financial struggles?
On my behalf, I do a lot of saving. I plan a lot. When the income comes in, I put it away. But it's not a lot to put away. Mm-hmm. I have to steal from myself maybe $10 out of each paycheck. That's not a lot, but over time it does accumulate. So I have a great bank in which I have more than one account. So I put a little bit in each account at a time. And my reserve account, I leave it there to it and draw interest. That's the only way I'm making ends meet. I know I have something to fall back on. Other than that, everybody doesn't have it. They don't have the know-how. And I would love to share. So why not? So that's why I taught my daughter how to save. I taught her how to maximize her money. I think she's tighter on the dollar bill than I am.
Who taught you?
I learned from ear hustling people's financial business. It works. I've learned from, like, sometimes they have like books on success and things. And I learned a lot from people that we actually moved in with when we were younger, when I was younger. And I learned when I'm in their house, I listen to Financial Woes, listen to house meetings and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's how you can do it. Because I didn't know it from my mom. My mom didn't know how to do what I know how to do right now. Now I can't teach her because she's now in a nursing home, full term, bedridden. And I can't teach her anything, but I manage her money.
We're going to be talking about resources at the end of the show. You have been in situations where you could have used some financial assistance.
Oh, lots of financial assistance.
Did you know where to go? What was that process like? If you needed some sort of assistance in the future, do you feel like you would know where to go or that you would have a likelihood of getting that support?
I know public assistance because back in the day, that's where I fell when I hit hard. That's where I relied on. I knew about public assistance because it's well known. What I didn't know is there other organizations and entities that has money and benefits available for people who need it. You just gotta search for it. At those government agencies, there are always papers posted up on the walls and stuff like that that nobody pays any attention to. I found that reading helps a whole lot when it comes down to looking around. And you can find a whole lot of things that they put out in the open that they don't publicize highly.
Doreen, what motivated you to get involved with United Workers?
I'm going to be honest about this. I slipped and tripped into United Workers. I went to a meeting that someone invited me to, and they were doing my favorite thing, crafts. Oh, my goodness. They were making puppets. And everybody had a black puppet, they had a white puppet, and everybody was making paper mache puppets. I was like, ooh, I'm enjoying this. So I went from one table that had all the dark brown paint, and I went over to the other table with the pink and white paint, and I mixed it together. And I made a beautiful tone of me. And everybody else was like, oh, where did you get that color from? All of a sudden, there were a rainbow of natural, beautiful colors of puppets. And I was like, ooh, I catalyzed something real nice. Everybody had different shades of dark and light colors. And I was like, this feels really good. I like this. Yeah. And then they served fried chicken. I was like, oh, I'm in love. All of a sudden, I started serving the food and all these other meetings. And I became a part of something lovely because I was angry for a very long time. I was wondering what was going on with my life. I was spinning out of proportion. I was going to the gym to release anger from high school all the way up until adulthood. And finally, I got a place where everybody's at who's like me, and they're doing stuff that I like. Win-win situation for me. I said, they are doing something I want to be a part of.
A bill passed the General Assembly that would gradually start increasing the minimum wage to $15 an hour, starting in 2020 and ending in 2026. I know you can't see into the future, but do you think that number will be sufficient to cover the cost of living?
Never. It's taking too long for us to get to 15. Right now, 15 may, and this is a big may, break people even with their bills and necessities in life. So if we're not getting 15 right now, I mean across the board, we're gonna be in the same predicament that we're in right now because inflation, everything is increasing, everything is rising, your rent's going up, food costs is going up, water bills going up. We're gonna be here, right here. So no. The richer are still going to be even richer, and the poorer are still going to be poor. There's no middle ground. We're not standing on solid ground at all. We're standing on half concrete, half quicksand. It's not helping us. It's helping us a little bit, but it's not bridging the gap.
How can people learn more about United Workers? Is that your hope, that more people will sort of turn their frustration and turn it into activism? How can they get involved if they want to do the same thing that you did?
Okay. You can volunteer by going to unitedworkers.org, hashtag United Workers, hashtag United Not Blighted. How about Rise, Reclaim, and Rebuild? You can go to any of those hashtags, find out about Free Your Voice, volunteer with any of those organizations. You can even go to our Facebook page, yeah, United Workers. And you can volunteer with your time or you can volunteer with your money. Any way that you want, any way that you feel that you can be of a benefit, you can come. We welcome everyone.
Thank you so much, Doreen.
You're very welcome.
We've been speaking with United Workers leader Doreen Hicks. You've been listening to Life in the Balance. I'm your guest host, Jamila Krempel. Coming up after the break, we'll dive into the United Way of Maryland's most recent ALICE report. ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. According to the report, 38% of Marylanders can't afford to live on a basic survival budget. What do the numbers tell us, and what can we do to help the thousands of families in this situation? Stay with us. Welcome back to Life in the Balance. I'm your guest host, Jamila Krempel. On the show today, we've been discussing the all-too-common financial difficulties many Marylanders face just trying to make ends meet. In the first portion of our program, we met Doreen Hicks, who works in the hospitality industry and is well acquainted with the struggles that come with living on a limited budget. Now we're turning our attention to the 2018 ALICE report released by the United Way of Maryland. As a reminder, ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. To discuss the report and its findings, we're joined by Franklin Baker. He's the president and CEO of the United Way of Central Maryland. Franklin, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jamila. It's glad to be here.
Can you briefly acquaint our listeners with the work of the United Way?
Yes, United Way of Central Maryland, we unite and engage communities to improve people's lives. So essentially, United Way of Central Maryland makes our community stronger. So we work directly with families and individuals, particularly those who are ALICE, as we'll be talking about today, to keep them in their homes, keep them out of shelters, to keep their kids from falling behind in school, and with people who need easier access to healthy food, and also individuals who need access to jobs that pay a living wage. So we achieve all of this critically with the help of our partners. All of our volunteers, our donors, other nonprofits are so important in our work. Area businesses and all of these various entities share our passion to make lives and neighborhoods much more stable and healthier.
There's two measurements relevant to this conversation, the federal poverty level and the ALICE threshold. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, so the federal poverty level is an outdated, sort of outmoded way of measuring a person's level of financial hardship. And as I said, it really doesn't keep pace with the changes in the environment, the various factors that impact a family. It doesn't keep pace with the cost of living as it increases.
Okay.
So ALICE, though, are people who are working one, two, maybe in some cases more jobs than that, but they still can't make ends meet because the high cost of living, as I was saying. And so they fall into this sort of gray area. So they make too much to qualify for federal assistance or state assistance, but they don't make enough to afford the basic necessities in life like housing and food and transportation, child care, and health insurance. So in Maryland, a whopping 38% of our residents are classified as ALICE, right?
And how do you classify them? Sort of what's the standard? I know the federal poverty limit for a four-person household is about $24,000.
Correct. So the average median household income in Maryland, based upon this study, is $78,945 for a family of four.
Okay.
Right? And so the individuals that you just stated for a family of four qualifying for the federal poverty level is the 24,000 number you just mentioned. So there's this gulf between the federal poverty level and the top end of ALICE threshold, right? So about most of the people that we serve in the community in partnership with nonprofits, they're up to 300% of the federal poverty level, which is somewhere around this $78,000 number that turns out to be the average median household income for a family of four. Now, in other jurisdictions throughout the state, the numbers vary.
Mm-hmm. And I know that in the report, you break it down by hourly wages. What are the majority of Maryland residents earning?
Right. So the report brings out a fascinating number. They're about 53% of the actual workers that are classified as ALICE that earn between $10 and $20 per hour.
Okay.
So the other thing I would suggest to your listeners, the average median household income in Baltimore is $47,350. And so depending upon the jurisdiction, so between Howard County or Somerset or Carroll County, the numbers are all over the map. So the average is about $78,945, but in Baltimore City is $47,350. So it really is fascinating, this report, because it breaks it down by jurisdiction within each state.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of course, there's income and then there's cost. The term survival budget is used in the report. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, the household survival budget, it reflects the very bare minimum that a household needs to live and work today. It does not include things like savings for emergencies. It doesn't include future goals like college. It does not include a savings fund, just a regular savings fund. Family costs increased by 27% statewide from 2010 to 2016. And so a survival budget for a family of four in Maryland is more than $69,000 for a survival budget. So as you can see, the average median income at 78, right, is just slightly higher than what we classify in this report as a survival budget of 69, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in contrast, the annual salary before taxes for someone working a minimum wage job is about $21,000 a year, and significantly higher than the federal poverty level, as we talked about earlier, which does not accurately reflect current local cost of living.
So how much does it cost to survive in Maryland? I know that there's a table, and I hope we'll provide a link on the website so our listeners can see this. But we're looking at sort of two types of people, single with no kids, and two income households with kids. And it's important to note that you're looking at families, adults who work full time. So can you sort of give us the breakdown? How much does it cost to survive in Maryland?
Yes. Yeah, so for, as we were mentioning just briefly, for a family of four in Maryland.
With a survival budget, I should say, to clarify.
That's correct. With a survival budget, it takes about $69,000. For some people listening to that, it seems pretty shocking that's an amount that seems for some people to be a sizable amount. You should be able to really do better than just survive. But when you factor in those six various categories of housing and food, transportation, child care, health insurance, and taxes, when you factor all of those things in, it becomes very clear that $69,000 truly is, in Maryland, right, just surviving. And there's another sustainability budget that we can talk about in a moment, but that gives the real sense of what it really takes to thrive and to actually do some of the things like savings and college funds and rainy day funds, emergency funds, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So the majority of these Alice families are not able to save for retirement or save up for a house or, you know, as you said, have that rainy day fund.
Yeah, more than 75% of them find it difficult just maintaining $400 in savings. Mm-hmm. That is incredibly difficult to think about, right? Because any little thing, right, a medical emergency, anything with your car repair,
sure,
can really cost more than $400. And so to think about the plight of those individuals, even though they're making as much as $69,000 as a family, still that is what's happening.
Yeah. In the section of the report about low-wage jobs, which is prevalent in Maryland, one of the sentences reads, a full-time job that pays $15 per hour grosses $30,000 per year, which is less than half of the household survival budget for a family of four in Maryland. That's a huge gap between earnings and expenses. Do you have any insight on what these Alice families are doing to fill in the gap?
Yeah, so for us, this is a nice, wonderful way to connect to some of the work of United Way of Central Maryland. So since 2012, we have focused on this effort called the Family Stability Initiative, and we have a caseworker who is assigned to 20 families in a neighborhood. So right now, we have 16 neighborhoods where we have a caseworker assigned to those families. And since 2012, by working in partnership with nonprofits in the community using our model, we have stably housed almost 2,000 families, which means that those families have avoided eviction, they've not entered into shelter, they've been rapidly rehoused where needed. And that number is about 98.4% of the people that have entered into our Family Stability Initiative have actually avoided any sort of eviction or any sort of shelter entry, right? Mm-hmm. And they've been stabilized. And so 99.4% of the students that are tied to those families, which is about 2,700 students since 2012, have actually avoided a very disruptive school transfer. So they've remained in their school of origin. They haven't skipped from school district to school district during the school year. Mm-hmm. And then about 50% of those families that are in this program have actually had documented increases to their household incomes. So what our caseworker does through the nonprofits we work with is they literally wrap themselves around the family, pointing them to resources, whether it's an internship or externship or apprenticeship or skills development that they may not be aware of in their community. So they're pointing them to those resources in community that gives them an opportunity to sort of move closer towards self-sufficiency.
I see. And are you helping them, are you providing financial assistance for these families in this program so that they're able to stay in their homes? You said avoid evictions.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So in some cases, it may cost about $5,000 to prevent someone from going into eviction status or losing their home or getting removed from their apartment. But it actually, by contrast, costs up to $35,000 to $40,000 to handle that on the back end, like once they've been evicted, the costs that are associated with that legal and otherwise. So for us, this is all preventative. This is why we call it preventative or prevention, homelessness prevention, because the investment is very small, but it has huge ROI, huge dividends when you think about what it doesn't cost the system and in the actual less trauma, right, depressive symptoms that end up happening to a student or family that are out on the street.
What is the United Way's position on what can be done to make more local families financially secure, sort of on the broader level, looking at legislation or broader efforts than more than what just the United Way alone can do?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct that one of the critical pieces for us is advocacy, public policy, working alongside nonprofits and other interested parties around the key issues that matter, particularly around workforce development or jobs or employment, particularly around food insecurity or concerns that deal with preventing individuals from entering into shelter and all the wraparound supports for those individuals in that category. So we really certainly want to make sure we're partnering with companies, with community activists, with churches, with community groups that really do care about these things. Living wage, making sure that is something that is front and center for legislators. We are generally taking a very neutral posture related to matters such as this, but we will certainly take a hardline stance on things like earned income tax credit or child tax credit, expanding who's eligible for those benefits at the federal and state level, encouraging the state legislature, for example, to increase the number of people who would be eligible to receive those benefits. And we're working on a variety of other studies, one of which we are working on is called a Benefits Cliff Study. It will be produced sometime this summer. But the main goal of this is that there may be a person who is currently earning $32,000 a year. They get an increase of $5,000 on their job. And that person can, if they have a kid or two, can end up losing or forfeiting federal and state benefits because their dollar amount for the salary hit a certain number. So it's an automatic trigger. So getting legislators and others in the community to understand, our main goal is to decrease the number of barriers for ALIS families and individuals, and also to increase their assets. So if we can shape and craft legislation that does a good job of protecting that, then I think we have done our jobs as citizens in the state of Maryland. So I think for United Way, it is balancing directly supporting the families and individuals in the various neighborhoods throughout our footprint, also monitoring and supporting legislation and policy that can shape, where resources are sent, as well as sort of providing protections, for families.
Well, Franklin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jamila. Really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Franklin Baker, President and CEO of the United Way of Central Maryland. If you're just joining us, you've been listening to Life in the Balance. I'm your guest host, Jamila Kremple. Coming up, we'll be joined by Nicole Battle, CEO of GEDCO, a Baltimore-based nonprofit that's filling in the gaps for people in need. We'll learn more about their services and wrestle with the question of whether we're getting to the root causes of poverty or just addressing its symptoms. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Jamila Kremple, your guest host for this episode of Life in the Balance. Today on the show, we've been discussing making ends meet in 2019 and why so many Maryland residents, including those who have full-time jobs, still aren't financially secure. Some find themselves having to make agonizing choices between necessities, food or filling a prescription, keeping the lights on or paying the water bill. Many people in these situations find themselves navigating social services, which is inundated with requests. And they often aren't aware that there are nonprofits in the area that may be able to provide the help they're looking for. GEDCO is one of those nonprofits. GEDCO, which stands for the Govens Ecumenical Development Corporation, was started in 1984 by a group of seven pastors from different denominations and parishes in the North Baltimore neighborhood of Govens. GEDCO has since grown to include over 50 member organizations. To talk more about GEDCO's services and the residents it serves, we're now joined by Nicole Battle, CEO of GEDCO. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I explained a little bit of GEDCO's history in the intro, but tell us where the idea came from. What needs were the founders trying to address?
Sure. I'm glad you mentioned 1984, these seven pastors got together, one being Reverend Jack Sharp. And he was the Presbyterian pastor of Govan's Presbyterian Church on York Road. And he had come from Delaware, and he was really just like a grassroots kind of community organizing type pastor. And basically, he was seeing along the York Road corridor, there were many families or individuals just stopping at the various churches, asking for either money or, you know, for their utilities or for their rent or food or other supplies. And so one of the biggest challenges he was seeing was there were seniors in his church as well as the other churches who just needed affordable housing with services. And so he got six other pastors together, and these pastors purchased a building, were able to get funding, and rehabbed an old Civil War hotel, which right now is called Epiphany House, and it's right on York Road. And it was our first project that was completed in 1984, 1985, before we were actually formally Govan's Ecumenical Development Corporation. And so it was from there that they just kind of built their little mini empire in Northeast Baltimore. But Govan's Ecumenical Development Corporation is, Govan's is the area that we started, ecumenical because these pastors were from various denominations, development because we were starting to do development corporation.
I see. From there. And give us a brief overview of the types of services that you provide now.
Sure. So GEDCO really addresses many of the social ills that we see today. We address poverty, unemployment, hunger, social isolation, homelessness, drug addiction, mental illness, all within the umbrella of GEDCO. And we address them through our various lines of business, one being real estate development, senior services, homeless and supportive services, and community services.
At the beginning of the show, we met a woman named Doreen. She's worked a number of jobs, but if an emergency happens, she's forced to dip into her savings, sometimes using all of it. She's unique in that she has savings, which many people don't. So many people are just one difficulty away from a major financial disaster. This is something, obviously, that GEDCO has noticed as a problem for many people in the community. You have an emergency financial assistance center. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So that's CARES. It's located in the basement of St. Mary's Church on York Road, 5502 York Road. And basically, through CARES, it's kind of like our community outreach arm where we're able to assist new people every day. And so through CARES, we have a food pantry, we have an employment center, we have a computer lab, we also have eviction prevention assistance, prescription assistance, utility assistance. It really helps the individual or their families just if there's any type of emergency services or emergency needs, they come to CARES and we try our best to address those needs.
Can you speak a little bit about the goal of GEDCO's work? Is it to help people who are facing a temporary financial problem, or is it to help them sort of become more stable?
It's really kind of both. You know, our mission in partnership with faith-based and community organizations, we provide housing and supportive services. All of our housing is permanent. To seniors as well as people who are formerly homeless, as well as emergency services for community residents. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that we help on a regular basis just through the housing and services we offer within our residential communities. But through CARES, it's really whoever comes through. If there is an emergency, we try our best to help. And if we can't help, we refer them to someone we feel that can. But our ultimate goal is to help everyone that comes through our doors.
And how do people find you?
So we have various partners in the community. So when you refer to social services, it may be the Office of Aging. It may be the Office of Human Services that usually refer people. If you go to one of the churches, 30 churches that are part of our membership, they'll refer you to us. And then, you know, CARES, lots of people know CARES. We're one of the most successful job hubs in the city, and we have a really good relationship with the mayor's office. So they usually refer people, and then it's word of mouth. We've helped so many people, and we've been around for almost, you know, over 30 years. The word gets out that if you need something, reach out to CARES or you reach out to GEDCO.
And of course, there's people all over the city who need support. But what is it? Give our listeners sort of a picture of the York Road corridor, the greater community, sort of what the community's needs are versus the individual needs, if there's a difference.
Well, it's really interesting because York Road has changed since we started. It's really, there's various communities along the York Road corridor, and we're northeast. So we're, you're looking at our catchment area starting at maybe Cold Spring and moving north to right above Northern Parkway.
Okay.
So if you're familiar, you know, you have the Govins neighborhood, you have Wilson Park, you have, you know, Penlucie, which are growing communities, but some have challenges. You also have Guilford on the other side of the road. So it's a very mixed community. And what we're seeing is really probably a lot of people coming from the south that are coming to CARES or coming to see us over at Stadium Place. But it's interesting enough, people find us. And I can't even really say that it's localized to specific areas. It's really all over the city. You know, I mentioned Stadium Place, where we provide mixed income housing for seniors, no matter what their background or their income. We get people from all over the city, even all over the state. So it's, people are resourceful when they have a need. We're seeing that. And, you know, because we're a small nonprofit, we have to be resourceful and just try to figure out how we can address all the need that we see.
Do you think we're focusing enough on eliminating poverty itself and not just responding to it?
That's a very good question.
And not just in your organization.
No. That's a really good question. I know from our organization standpoint, we have been more just responding. I think by introducing the whole employment center, we really tried to figure out how we could address getting rid of it by just empowering people so that they can make their way. But it's just, it's hard.
The expenses
are just, they're killing people, you know? I go to just Safeway, and it's crazy too, because there are certain Safeways that are more expensive than other Safeways. Same with, you know, Giant. And it's challenging for people. Just their day-to-day expenses, gas is expensive.
Sure.
You know, buying food, you can go to the grocery store, buy one meat item and spend $50. You know, so it's going to be hard unless you raise the salaries for people to meet their expenses. That's the only way that, you know, you could even come close. And with, depending on where people want to live, I mean, the hardest thing is just finding safe, decent, and affordable housing in Maryland. And Maryland's like one of the highest cost states
Sure.
to live. I mean, just your housing expenses. We're seeing people in, just in our senior services programs, where they may have started living with us and they, you know, they were right in line of spending no more than 35% of their income on housing. If their income has changed in any way, a family member or a spouse has passed, they're spending more of their money on just housing expenses. And, you know, everybody knows how BG&E and utilities are. So, I mean, it's going to be hard. I don't think we're going to really address that poverty need, because you have everything, those outside forces that are just increasing, but your income, your expenses are increasing, but your income isn't keeping up. And I think from GEDCO's standpoint, it's troublesome, because you want to help, you want to address it, but we're only responding to those needs as they come about. And we're not even, you know, we're not even the best at responding. It really does take a village or a lot of partners, and that's what we're seeing, and that's how we're able to do what we do. But yeah, we're all responding. I don't see how we can get rid of poverty the way things are going.
Sure. There's stand-up organizations and businesses and government agencies that offer help to people who need it. But there's also, for lack of a better word, a market that targets vulnerable people. Mm-hmm. Give our listeners a picture of how this affects the clients you serve.
Sure. So recently, probably about a couple of months ago, we have been seeing third-party utility providers that have reached out to our seniors and really the most vulnerable and they're setting up shop like at Walmart's or social service agencies, really convincing people to sign on to get a reduced rate for their utilities or their BG&E bills. And what happens is it's temporary. It's, you know, it's almost like a variable rate. And, you know, they'll get like a relief or a cheaper utility bill for like a couple of months. And they're, you know, they're feeling good about themselves. And then 3 to 4 months later, their utilities are higher than they were before, mm-hmm. because there's extra fees tied to just the other fees that, you know, BG&E or Pepco usually have. So this is really becoming it's very challenging for the people we serve. We've been working with, you know, our councilwoman, Mary Pat Clark, Delegate Brooke Learman, on just really addressing these issues in our community. And, you know, you're seeing it all through Maryland now. So it's, you know, when Delegate Learman reached out to us, it's definitely at a state level and they're focusing on it. But yeah, that's one of the recent challenges we're seeing for the people that we serve. Mm.
If someone is listening who needs help, or if they know someone who needs help, what would be your message to them?
Please reach out to us, GEDCO, 410-433-2442. You can reach out to me, extension 13, or go to our website, www.gedco.org, or go to CARES, 5502 York Road, the basement of St. Mary's, 9 to 11, Monday through Thursday. Saturday mornings, you know, our food pantry's open from 9 to 11 as well. But that would be my recommendation.
And in your interactions with clients, and as we've kind of talked about in this segment, you know, it just can seem very overwhelming, all of the financial demands and sort of just the stress it takes, the toll it takes on a person or a family. Mm-hmm. How do you, not that you counsel them, but what do you say to them just to show support or to give them some hope?
You know, I think just answering a call or talking to someone and being respectful goes a long way. You know, when you're struggling, you feel bad anyway when you're asking for help. And sometimes people just need someone to just care, a smile, not to have them running around, just answer their questions directly and point them to the right place. And I think that, for me, that's what I try to do. I mean, we do so much, but just taking the time, and my staff is like that too, just really taking the time to just address a person's need as opposed to just sending them around just, you know, from place to place. I think that's what really helps.
Well, thank you so much, Nicole, for telling us about your work.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Nicole Battle, Chief Executive Officer of GEDCO. You've been listening to Life in the Balance. If you want to learn more about the organizations and people you heard from today, or listen to previous episodes, visit our website, www.wypr.org/lifeinthebalance. Life in the Balance airs the first Wednesday of every month at 1 p.m. and again at 9 p.m. The show is produced and edited by Katie Marquette. Thanks for your help on this episode, Katie. I've been your guest host, Jamila Krempel. Thanks for listening.